capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to Level Talk Programme. Over the past 40 years, we've seen a lot of major crises in the Middle East. The blockade of Gaza, Iraqi wars, there's a coup in Turkey just recently, Syria at war, millions of refugees have taken to the roads. Now, all of these events have been happening. Not even three Arab countries were able to come together at the same time and agree on joint action. Yet, a large coalition of countries, including Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, Yemen, the Eastern Government and Libya, have united against the relatively tiny country of Qatar on June the 5th and enforced a blockade, seriously threatening its trade and even food supplies. This is the first time that in 50 years that such a great alliance has formed of Arab leaders. The question is, why? Are we perhaps not aware of the whole story, or are we simply witnessing the new shape of Middle East and Gulf politics? To hopefully unravel some of the secrets of this incredibly complex story, I welcome to the programme Dr. Simon Maben, lecturer in international relations at the University of Lancaster, and Daniel Pipes, a US historian and president of the Middle East Forum, an American think tank on the Middle East. Welcome to the programme, gentlemen.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Million-dollar question. What exactly has Qatar done to upset its Arab neighbours so much? And I'm going to start by asking you, Daniel, please, to have a go at that one.
It's been about a quarter of a century that the Qataris, who, as you pointed out, are very few in number, have been very active in creating relationships, in exposing news, in funding movements that have constantly been irritating to the Saudis and to others. And finally, they took this dramatic step earlier this month.
Daniel, could I ask you, are you referring to Al Jazeera in Qatar? Is that the...
Al Jazeera is one factor. Mm-hmm. Al Obeid military base that the United States uses is a second. Mm-hmm. The funding of Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist movements is a third. The close alliance with Turkey is a fourth. The open relations with Iran, on and on. Now, what's so striking is that Qatar is the only other state besides Saudi Arabia to have a Wahhabi outlook. And the Saudis have for a long time seen Qatar as a younger sibling, but especially under Hamad, the ruler from 1995 till a couple of years ago, the Qataris took on this very, very active foreign policy that has been in part needling the Saudis. And the Saudis just couldn't take it any longer. And they got some friends together to take these dramatic steps, which, interestingly, are more anti-Qatar. The Saudi and Egyptian and other UAE, Bahrain policies these days are more anti-Qatar than anti-Israel.
It's very interesting. Do you agree with that, Dr. Maben? This is a combination of various different factors, including antagonism towards Saudi Arabia, and I suppose a friendship with Iran and Turkey influence coming in here, and we're seeing a sort of a split between the Brotherhood. The unity of the Gulf Cooperation Council is under threat because of this.
I think so. I think it's quite a serious measure to take for just one particular issue, for one real schism in diplomatic relations. So I think that it is a multifaceted reason, that there are a range of different reasons at play. But I think that it's really sort of existential for the Saudis. There are two main issues, I would argue. The first is that it's this Qatari relationship with particular Islamist groups that's a real bone of contention, which fundamentally gets right at the heart of the Saudi state, this real alliance that the Saudis have with this fringe Islamic sect, the Wahhabis, as Daniel correctly notes. But that fringe sect becomes increasingly threatened by a range of other actors who have much greater sway and influence across the Muslim world, particularly their legacy of involvement, their credibility, their legitimacy. And so Qatar's support for these This range of groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood, including Hamas, offers a real source of concern for the Saudis, for other sort of status quo players in the region. And obviously, in addition to that, is the concern about the increasing support for Iran, which, again, is seen to be going against the status quo. And I quite like the idea that Qatar and the Saudis are sort of viewed as siblings. And Qatar is certainly the younger sibling trying to get one over its elder brother, its much more powerful brother. And finally, Riyadh has said, you know what, enough is enough. We're not going to tolerate this anymore. And it seems that it's a cumulative effect that's taken place over decades.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, Qatar seems to me to being a sort of playing a role a bit like Britain. You know, it's okay for us, isn't it, to have offices of Al Jazeera and Al Qaeda and even probably Daesh in very different forms and guises, all in London, and to sort of have our national government there. And everybody gets on quite well together. We drink tea together. But in the Arab world, I suppose, it's not okay, is it? You've got to sort of play by the rules of the game. And if one country steps out of line, particularly if they are all members of a cooperative council, then that's a no-no. There's a certain red line which you're not allowed to go over. Is that what's happened?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the sense that Islam serves as a double-edged sword. It serves to legitimize particular rules, but then it can also serve to undermine and to criticize that same ruling elite. So if you're viewed to not be Islamic enough, or if your practices and your rule is viewed to be un-Islamic, then that same rhetoric that you use to prop up and legitimize your own regime can be used against you. And what the Qataris have done is made Doha a safe space for a number of groups that have long been a thorn in the side to regional status quo powers. So we see the Muslim Brotherhood, who've long been a source of opposition to Egyptian rulers. And particularly since the Arab uprisings and the support that the Qataris gave to the Brotherhood when they were ruling, that was a real source of contention to the Saudis. So creating this atmosphere that gave rise to other types of Islamist groups was a serious problem for the Saudis.
There's two things that strike my kind of uneducated mind. Firstly, where is America? Where is Britain? Where are the great traditional powers that sort these things out? Are we seeing the emergence of really a Middle Eastern consciousness, Middle Eastern power in its own, that now, guys, okay, it's our time now, we're taking control, we're going to sort our own problems out? The second issue I would like to bring up with you is one of Iran, and that Iran is now being isolated again. I think we're moving towards that, and Daniel, you can shoot me down if I'm wrong, by the United States. And suddenly we see Qatar trying to forge relations with Iran. Okay, well, they're not, at least it's not supporting the isolation of Iran. And this is also something that's...
On your first point, the U.S. policy is a bit difficult to understand because on the one hand, the Secretary of State said that we look forward to relations being improved and the crisis coming to an end. And then the President replies by saying, oh no, we're supporting the Saudis against Qatar. And indeed, I had a role in bringing this crisis about. So, as is typical in the Trump era, we have a muddle of a policy with contradictions, and no one's quite sure what it all means. As for Iran, the danger here, I'm more sympathetic to the Saudis than to the Qataris. I think the Qataris have been taking mistaken moves. But that said, I think that the Saudis have responded in an immature, hasty, and unthinking way. They went too far. They didn't map out what all this means. They're having to retreat in some ways. And most importantly, I think it could lead the Qataris, instead of reconciling and being humbled and coming back into the GCC fold, instead turning ever more to Iran and Turkey. And one can imagine in a worst-case scenario that the Saudis would not stand for that, might use troops to invade Qatar, whose native population is about 1/100th the size of the Saudi population. And one can imagine the Iranians coming to the support and the Turks coming to the support of Qatar. One can imagine this degenerating into war. So I rue the fact that the the Saudi-led coalition took these hasty and somewhat immature steps.
Dr. Maimon, do you think it could come to that? Do you think it is a really serious Middle Eastern crisis just starting to brew now, and we're just seeing the beginning of this?
I think that crises in the Middle East have increasingly been taking place with the possibility that they could escalate. We see battle lines being drawing in, or with the potential to draw in, a range of different actors. Unfortunately, we've not seen those escalate to the point of out-and-out conflict between all of these different sides as yet, but it certainly has the potential to escalate like that. But I think you're right to call into question the role of the U.S., because it seems to me that the U.S. and Washington gave a bit of a green light to the Saudis to take this type of action. When Trump went out to visit the region, he seemed to spend a lot of time with the Saudis and with the Emiratis, and that sort of gives the impression that the U.S. was implicitly condoning what would happen. But then on the flip side, you see the Americans and the Qataris agreeing a deal to sell and buy various aircraft. So it seems that there's a bit of a contradictory policy here, and I think that that's got to be ironed out if we want to get a clear, longer-term resolution to this problem.
This alliance between Qatar and Turkey is, wrong word, not alliance, but this development of military base.
Yeah, it's important to mention that the sale of aircraft, it is $12 billion U.S. dollars worth of aircraft. It's a huge, huge sale that's been announced, just at a time.
But it's tiny in compared to what the Saudis have just agreed with the U.S., which is somewhere in the region of $1 trillion, I've read some estimates, over a longer-term, much larger arms package. When you factor in the arms sales, when you factor in all of the broader implications of that, what it'll do for the U.S. economy. So it really is a pittance in the grand scheme of things.
Most observers think this is a natural progression of things, but the question that comes into my mind, like, what is Turkey trying to achieve here? What is Turkey's vision?
The Turkish vision is what's sometimes called neo-Ottoman, not conquering the Middle East, as was the case hundreds of years ago, but rather having influence over the Middle East and on the Balkans and the areas where the Ottomans had been. And Qatar happens to be the country, the regime, that is most closely aligned with Recep Tayyip Erdogan's vision of the future. They work together in supporting Islamist movements. They have a formal alliance. There is a Turkish military base in Qatar, right after the Saudi-led coalition took these steps.
Yes.
In early June, the Turkish parliament immediately formalized and increased the relationship with Qatar. It is a rather strange relationship between a country with 90 million citizens and one with 250,000, but the Qataris are per capita the richest people in the world. They have access to ownership of the largest, or part of the largest gas reserve in the world, and they punch way above their weight.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about that interesting factor, the gas, after a short break.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Program. I'm talking to Dr. Simon Maimon from the University of Lancaster and Daniel Pipes, a U.S. historian and president of the Middle East Forum, about the Qatari blockade. Now, gentlemen, we were just starting to come on to perhaps one of the most important aspects of this Pandora's box of problems, that is Qatari, and the blockade was announced on June the 5th. You've just said, Daniel, that Qatar is sitting on a huge amount of gas. I believe it's the third largest gas reserve in the world, 51 trillion cubic metres of natural gas in the South Pars gas field, which is shared by Qatar and Iran. And this is in a situation where the world seems to be gradually moving towards a heavy dependency on gas rather than liquid oil. This plays, you know, into the hands, doesn't it, of Qatar and Iran, and probably will give them an increasingly powerful role to play on the energy market. Is this part of it? Saudi Arabia is getting a little bit angry with this tiny neighbor down south, which is playing its own independent views very, very loudly, very, very well through its media organization that you mentioned earlier on.
I wouldn't say that the economic dimension is that important. They are rivals in to a small extent, but by and large, the gas and oil markets are somewhat independent of each other, and the Saudis have mostly oil and Qataris have mostly gas. I don't think that's the key to this issue. It really is about the political and religious dimensions, the alliances, the media, and so forth.
Dr. Maidman, do you agree with that, that it's not anything to do with the energy?
I agree with the sentiment of what Daniel's saying, but I would say that there is an economic and a resource dimension to it, because we have seen in the past the Saudis have used the price of oil as a means of trying to have political influence over the Iranians. They've driven down the price of oil in the past far below their break-even price, which is much lower than the Iranians, so that they could take a hit on each barrel of oil sold, with the assumption that the Iranians would take an even bigger hit, which would obviously damage the Iranian economy. And they've used this on a number of occasions, this sort of weaponization of resources and sale of resources. So I think that there's probably a bit of a dimension there, because
yes,
with this move towards natural gas rather than oil, that suggests that the Saudis are going to lose quite an area of leverage over the Iranians. And let's not forget, this is predominantly about Iran. The Saudis are concerned with two main areas. The first is this threat from Islamist groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, various other groups of that ilk. But they're also predominantly concerned with the rising influence of Iran, and that's where we start to see the shift away from the State of Israel, as you mentioned right at the start, towards more of a focus on Iranian influence across the region and doing what it can, along with its GCC allies, to try and counter that Iranian influence.
What I find so fascinating is that in all this hullabaloo that's going on, Qatar has not cut the supply to Saudi Arabia of natural gas. Saudi Arabia receives 40% of its gas supply from Qatar.
Right, there still are areas where they cooperate. And the Qataris are not interested in exacerbating the problem. They're hoping it will end rather than get worse.
Yeah, I guess it's, for me, just interesting that Saudi Arabia depends so heavily on Qatari gas, being an oil-exporting country.
The whole world has become more dependent on natural gas.
Yeah. Okay, now, if we go back to your country, Daniel, there is a theory, perhaps you may call it a controversy theory, I don't know, that as the US has opted to adopt a strategy that will enable the US to support its own energy needs and produce enough shale gas and oil to export, destabilization in the Middle East, in a way, is not a bad thing. I'm not saying that the US has created the situation, I'm saying anything like that. But at the same time, I'm perhaps hinting that destabilization of competitors could be seen as a good thing.
I would not agree with that. The price of gas and oil, the energy market, is global, and no responsible person in the United States wishes to see the price go through the roof for ourselves or for our allies. We don't want to see the oil producers and gas producers get a whole lot more money, particularly Venezuela, Russia, and Iran. Yes, the U.S. has become less dependent on imports of energy than it was some years ago, but still, the United States is part of the global market and is not, I can't see any indication that the prior or the current administrations are interested in creating havoc in the energy market.
Okay, and hence Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia and the sort of gluing of relations there and sort of, everything's okay, you know, we're still going to support you guys, everything's all right, doesn't matter what's going on in Yemen, we still maybe basically maintain the same Obama-type Middle Eastern policy into the Trump years.
So I think there's been a bit of a shift there, to be honest. I think that under Obama, there was a real fractious relationship between the Saudis and the Americans. And you saw that with Obama making a number of really public statements condemning the Saudis for their performance, for their behavior, and calling on them to, and this is a direct quote, to share the region, to become more responsible and to share the governance of the region with the Iranians. And obviously that didn't go down too well in Riyadh. So there was a real fractious sort of relationship there. And Trump, I think, was increasingly aware of that. And there are many in the Gulf who are actually quite favorable of the Trump presidency because they see him as a businessman. They see him as someone who's pragmatic. And they see him as someone who can actually build personal relationships with these prominent families and figures. And that's really important out in the Gulf. That idea of personal politics and personal relationships is really key. So I think we see Trump trying to reset these relationships, particularly with the Saudis, and trying to build a more positive future with the Saudis.
So in a way, kind of playing it safe, you know, not putting all your eggs in one basket. And I mean, the UK's already long gone, hasn't it? The UK's influence in the Middle East is negligible, it seems to me now. And do I hear you right, Dr. Maben, you're saying that the US is actually kind of pulling out, in a way, of the Middle East?
Well, I'm not sure that it's pulling out as yet. It realises that it's still a really important region, it's still a really important sphere of influence. And there was perhaps more credence to that statement under the Obama regime when it looked like he was going to pivot more to Asia. But Trump is conscious of the need to be based in the region. He's conscious of the importance of the fight against Daesh. He's obviously very strong in his criticism of the Iranians. And you see, obviously, there's still this U.S. base in Qatar. So that suggests that the U.S. is still quite prominently featured in, the Middle East is still featuring heavily in U.S. strategic calculations. But it also features heavily for the U.K. as well. We've still got a naval base in Bahrain, and it's increasingly important that we maintain strategic influence in the Middle East, not only for our Middle East policy, but also for security policy across the Horn of Africa. And the British Navy have a very important base in Bahrain for operations across the Horn of Africa. So it's really important that Britain maintains its influence there. And while you're right to say that that's diminishing, I don't think it's quite as negligible as you suggest.
Right, but yet neither of these two countries, the UK or the USA, is actually playing an active role in this present situation. I mean, we're saying all sorts of...
We don't know that. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I would argue to you that in the Trump months, the Middle East could not be more prominent. Trump's first foreign visit was, of all places, to Saudi Arabia. Not exactly a traditional destination. His son-in-law, who is understood to be his number one advisor, is at present in the Middle East. His Secretary of State is an oil man. Focus was very largely on the Middle East. His ambassador to the United Nations has made a name for herself by talking about the Middle East. The only special ambassador for negotiations is to the Middle East. The Middle East is extremely high profile. No other region can remotely compare with it. So talk of...
Okay, Daniel, now you've got me really worried, okay, as a journalist. I can't help thinking that there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. We just are not getting the full story. Would you be so kind as to enlighten us? What is actually going on in Qatar?
I wish I knew what was going on behind the scenes, but I do expect there is something going on. I don't think we know the full story at this point.
We don't know the full story. Dr. Maben, have you got any idea?
So I think we're touching on a number of the issues that are at play. I think that what we're seeing is that it's not just one issue, as I alluded to earlier on. This is the culmination, or perhaps not the culmination, but the latest sort of high point in tensions that have brought together a range of different factors. They're sort of reaching their zenith right now, and it's just a question of whether the Qataris, the Saudis, the Americans, the Brits, the Turks, the Iranians can come together to try and de-escalate things, because there is a danger that there are a range of different tensions, be it over the role of Islam, be it over the role of Iran, be it the role of the Americans. There are a lot of different tensions that have created quite a dangerous-looking powder keg, and it's just going to take one spark, and it could set the region off.
Yes, and would an explosion be a benefit to any one power, group of powers in the Middle East at the present time?
The Iranians are the revolutionaries, the disruptive agents who would be the most likely to welcome war, direct war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, confrontations, changing of boundaries, and so forth. Otherwise, the region is pretty much status quo oriented. Yes, the Turks wish to have more control, more influence, but they don't really want to change it fundamentally in the way the Iranians do. And the Saudi, that bloc, is very status quo oriented, as are most foreign powers. Even the Chinese are just working with the existing system. They're not trying to overthrow it.
Yeah, they're worried about the Silk Road, you know, through the Persian Gulf.
Right.
So really, in a few words, it's incredibly difficult, a complex situation. The outcome is not clear, but it still could escalate. This is not over. We were 2 weeks into this crisis now, and we do not see the end of it coming, do we? Kuwait, which is the official intermediary, has not even presented the country's demand, as far as I can understand.
That's right. We are just at the beginning of this. Potentially, it could get much worse. Potentially, it could be solved rather quickly. We on the outside really don't know which way it's going.
We should be very careful about what we think about Qatar. We should not blame these people without fully understanding the different sides. But the trouble is, it's difficult, isn't it? Because we don't know what the different sides are. And you need to have a degree in Middle Eastern studies to be able to fully understand it.
Yeah, and even then, we don't really fully understand it. Even with those degrees in Middle East studies, we aren't necessarily at the best place to fully understand it, because we just don't know all of the different machinations, all the different things that are at play. But one thing that we've not really touched on, but we really have to remember, is that the all sides have to try and save face here, and that no side is going to want to back down and lose face. That would be catastrophic for the Qataris, catastrophic for the Saudis. And so they really have to find a way out of this, a way of de-escalating things where they can save pride, where they can still say, we have come out of this as victors. Otherwise, we won't be able to get this resolved.
I thought that was an Eastern thing. You know, I thought that was China, you know, the Far East, not the Middle East. But it's a big thing. Losing face is a huge thing, is it?
Really is, yeah, because you need to be able to speak to a range of different actors. You need to be able to demonstrate that you're in control, that you have influence. And after all, that's one of the reasons why the Qataris have bid to host the World Cup in 2022. They want to exert their influence and show that they can operate on the world stage. But if they're backing down now, what, 5 years before the World Cup's due to take place,
yeah,
then that would be a seriously damaging thing for them. So I think that is really important. Finding a way of de-escalating this crisis while allowing people to save face is key if we want to actually get this resolved.
Right.
And I'd like to point out that all the major actors are Islamist. The Qatari government, the Saudi government, the Iranian, the Turkish, they're all promoting political Islam, but in different ways. So this is in many ways an Islamist crisis.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed, gentlemen, for telling us what you know about this crisis in Qatar and the Middle East as a whole, and perhaps opening our eyes to the fact that we do not know very much about this and we need to know more. And I think that courses in Middle Eastern studies all over the world should expect a huge influx of new students if we suddenly realize that we don't know anything at all about huge swathes of the planet that we live on. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Dr. Simon Mabon, lecturer in international relations at the University of Lancaster, and Daniel Pipes, U.S. historian and president of the Middle East Forum, an American think tank on the Middle East.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, listeners, for being with us today. I hope this program was interesting for you. It certainly was for me. Speak to you again next week. Goodbye.